The Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. This is Tuesday, January 20th, and we're going to hear a little bit about water issues today. Last week, we heard about energy, and as you know, this committee, colleagues, will be dealing with a lot of water issues. You've probably seen that there's some bills that have already been introduced, and I anticipate that they'll be coming through this committee. Of course, you know this is an issue near and dear to my heart. I actually have been working on water issues for about 25 years, the last 15 years in Oregon. They're quite complicated. I am not going to profess to still completely understand Western water law, because Dr. Campagna has probably been studying it for how many years? And you cannot, I don't know if anybody can say they completely, yeah. So it's really interesting, fascinating, and today you're going to have a little bit of background of how here in Oregon we're dealing with some of these issues. So I appreciate the members that are here. Hopefully we'll have a few more members in a little bit. And I also want to welcome our colleague, Senator Nelson, who's joined us here today. And I'm sure many of you know that actually Senator Nelson and I both share the Columbia Rivers in our district. Mm-hmm. I get it downstream, so everything that goes in the river comes right by my district. So I know you're very aware of that and make sure and send it cleaner going down. But Senator Nelson and I have been working on water issues together for 7 years and looking forward to working with you some more over on this side. And even though he's not an official member of the committee, I invited him to come join us. And, of course, you're welcome to join our committee anytime.
Thank you.
I just can't allow you to have a vote at this time. But
I don't want to. I'm in the minority. My vote doesn't count anyway.
But I wouldn't say that. But certainly I'm glad that you can join us, and feel free to ask any questions.
And I appreciate that, Chair. I really do. Thank you very much.
So today we're going to hear from the Water Resources Department. We have two doctors here today to present to us. We left off the doctor for Brenda Bateman, who is a senior policy coordinator with the Water Resources Department, and we're very fortunate to have her. She's been working for the department about a year, and we are fortunate that she's come to the department with her area of expertise. And then I invited Dr. Campagna from Oregon State University to come and present the results of the Oregon Water Roundtables that happened during the interim session. I was involved with those along with several other members of the legislature and lots of other folks, and you'll hear more about that today. I anticipate that we'll probably only go till maybe 4:15 or so, 4:30 if there's questions, and then we will have another informational hearing starting this Thursday. We're going to have informational hearings from DLCD and DEQ, but we'll actually have a public hearing, so stay tuned. Was that already posted?
Yes, it was.
Okay, so Senate Bill 79, we're actually going to have a public hearing on that on Thursday. And the following week, we'll have an informational hearing on cap and trade, climate change issues, and then start into more public hearings. We've just been waiting for the bills to be assigned to our committee, and that's starting to happen. So with that, I'd like to invite Dr. Bateman up to provide us with a little bit of an overview of the Oregon Water Resources Department. And as I mentioned, they have several bills that will be coming for us, and so I asked her to sort of provide the background information for those bills, and then we'll take questions after that. Do you have a PowerPoint presentation?
Yes, I do. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure for me to be here. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator for Oregon's Water Resources Department. And this afternoon, I'd like to provide just a brief overview of the department and some of the challenges that we're currently facing and the foundation that we're building upon as we move forward, and also a few legislative highlights that you are probably going to see in the next several months. Just very briefly, an overview of our water resources here in the state. We are fortunate to have a couple of sources to draw from. One is surface water that comes both from snowpack as well as rainfall, and then groundwater that comes from snowpack, rainfall, and what we call ancient water that is deep down in the ground in the basalts and has been there for a very long time and is very good quality for us to use.
Could you clarify for that as ancient water as to what the parameters are as to getting that definition?
You've already cornered me and gotten me to the limit of my technical expertise. One of the things that we are very fortunate to have here in Oregon are several layers of groundwater. And so when we talk about the snowpacks and the rainfall, that this is going to be in the shallow alluvial layers, and the rain is able to come in more quickly and also leave in terms of recharge and flow into streams and waters. There's also the deeper Columbia River basalts formations. I don't know the age of that water, but the point is that recharge is much slower, and once that water is pulled out, it would take a very, very long time for that amount of water to recharge again.
Senator?
Madam Chair, if I can. Mm-hmm. The reason I brought that up when you said it's some of this water has maybe been in the ground for many years, I had heard this summer when I was on a tour of part of the McKinsey River drainage, that there is areas where it takes 22 years or so for the water that might be coming off of the mountains, off the Cascades, to actually reach the McKinsey. Is that within the realm of possibility?
It would be within the realm of possibility, and there's quite a bit of press this past summer and fall regarding some of the Cascade aquifers. We're actually, we have a very strong groundwater section at the department, and we would love to come in and provide in detail a briefing of groundwater resources here in Oregon. We're very fortunate that they're quite complex, and there's quite a lot to talk about.
And also, Dr. Campagna, who is an expert in groundwater, can talk about it when he comes up.
Thank you.
I know he's from the other university, but he's an expert on groundwater.
He's a land grant man. I went to land grant school. We're fine.
Yeah.
I just represent the ducks.
Wanted to talk a little bit about how water is consumed in the state, and you can see from the pie chart here that agriculture actually comprises more than 80% of the consumption of the water. So I wanted to clarify make sure that you knew agriculture does not use more than 80% of the water in the state, but more than 80% of the water that is withdrawn from streams and groundwater and subsequently consumed. So that's an important distinction to make. But you can see that water is also very important to our municipal systems, domestic wells, domestic customers, and also industry. One key water use that we do need to talk about here is in-stream water use. And so this is water that is left in stream and is for the benefit of fish and wildlife, recreation, transportation, power, scenic waterways, and water quality purposes. And it is possible to apply for in-stream rights for these purposes so that this water can be protected in stream. And by statute, there are three state agencies here in Oregon that can apply for new in-stream rights for these very purposes, and they are Fish and Wildlife, DEQ, and also Parks. So those three agencies apply to the department, and Water Resources Department holds those rights in trust. Under the 1987 In-Stream Water Rights Act, Oregon has protected more water in stream using these mechanisms than any other western state, and in fact, more than many of our neighbors combined. So this is one of our in-stream successes. The other thing we like to point out, and the key here to the success, is in-stream water rights. What we like to point out is that more than 70% of the water that we've placed permanently back in stream and protected are considered to be pretty senior water rights, that is, older than 1909, which means that we'll talk a little bit more about how water rights work later, but an older right is definitely a very valuable one to have. So just briefly, how is water managed in Oregon? We have a number of natural resource departments and commissions that have different areas of specialty and responsibility when it comes to water. There are more than a dozen agencies who are involved in water somehow in Oregon, and all of their work is coordinated through the governor's natural resources cabinet. So here's a picture of cabinet meeting just a few days ago, and you can see just a sampling of the agencies down below who have some responsibility for water in Oregon. The Water Resources Department, we consider ourselves to be the water quantity agency. And unlike DEQ or the drinking water folks, we don't have any federal counterpart. So some of those other agencies are have EPA standards and rules that they look to as part of their work. There's no federal counterpart for us as a water quantity agency. We are responsible for the allocation and distribution of water in the state, and we do consult with other agencies, Fish and Wildlife, DEQ, et cetera, as part of our decision making. We have a Water Resources Commission, which is responsible for policy oversight, and that's a 7-member commission appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. So the department and commission have as their mission to serve the public by practicing and promoting wise, long-term water management. And there are two pieces to that. There's the stewardship piece, which is looking at the ecosystems, the stream flows, and the watersheds, and making sure those are protected. And then equally as important, ensuring that we're meeting current and future water needs and water supply at the state itself. Here's how we're organized. Very briefly, we have 5 departments, a total of 147 FTE or full-time equivalents. We have our technical services folks, and so these are most of our scientists and data managers. Our IT department is here. Our hydrogeologists and hydrologists are there. Then we have a water rights section and adjudication section, and so these are the folks that you would work with if you were applying for a water right. We have a field services division. You may have heard or met before some of our water masters, assistant water masters, and folks in our field offices and regional offices. They work in this group, and our transfer section is also here in this group. And then we have our administrators and our director's office, where the policy and legal work is done. I won't dwell on the slide, but it's really crucial to understand sort of how we're structured and how very dependent we are at this time on general funds. You can see that the majority of our programs are funded here. This is going to have implications for us as we have budget discussions over the next several months. So just a little bit of background about Oregon water law. Unless you've been involved in it intimately, it may seem a bit of a mysterious thing to you. This was formally established in 1909, so this year is our 100th year of Oregon water law. On February 24th, that will be the date. And under that law, we say all water is publicly owned, and therefore, with just a few exceptions, water users need to come to the state to request a water right or permit that establishes a priority date, which is important, and that's how you get permission to use water from any source. Like most of the states west of the Mississippi, Oregon uses a system called the Doctrine of Prior Appropriation, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, but that establishes a date and sort of shows you where you are in line. And the department at this point in time is responsible for more than 85,000 water rights. That's surface and groundwater combined. So 4 fundamentals of water rights that you'll hear us talk about as we go is that you need to use the water beneficially and without waste. This water can be legally diverted for use only if it's used without waste. And then the priority date is very important. The more senior you are, that means the longer you get to use water in times of scarcity.
Brenda, before you leave that point, can you explain to the committee about waste? Because it's a very important point, and I'm sure it'll come up in discussions on other bills, and how waste is defined.
It is. It's defined in statute, and the folks who are responsible for actually working with water rights holders and landowners on the ground are going to be our water masters. And so what they're looking for is the use for which the water right and permit have been written. So this would be a municipal use, an agricultural use, industrial use, and they want to make sure that that water is not flowing freely, running down the street, that type of thing, that it's being used beneficially for the purpose that's listed right there on the water right, the piece of paper that you have. It really depends from industry to industry what waste is. There's not one definition that transfers from one use, agriculture, to municipal. And it's definitely been the source of some discussions with customers in the department over the years. But this is an important point, that you cannot just run water for the heck of it. You need to use it, put it to the use for which it was listed on the water right and permit. The third fundamental is a pertinency, and that is to say that the water right is attached to the land. that's described in the right. So if the land is sold, the water right is going to go with the land to the new owner. And the fourth piece, as I mentioned before, is that the water must be used. So once it's established, a water right needs to be used as provided for in the right at least once every 5 years. Otherwise, the right is subject to forfeiture and possible cancellation. So we want to make sure that the water right remains viable and that it is, in fact, being used for the original purpose. So water law in Oregon has managed to evolve to address some of the concerns that have crept up over time. And I think in this case, Oregon is very well suited, or has a very well good record compared to some other states in this regard. You know, there were some things that weren't mentioned in the original 1909 law. For one, the example that's up here now is groundwater that went unmentioned previously. And so in 1955, the state added some statutes to make sure that ground law was brought into the system of water law. And there are a couple of other examples as well. Basin plans have authorized the state to manage water at a watershed level, at a smaller and more appropriate level than statewide. I mentioned earlier that we have the 1987 In-Stream Water Right Act that allowed Oregon to protect more water in-stream than any other western state. And finally, at that same time, 1987, we launched an allocation of conserved water program, which allows users, if they're able to conserve water and be more efficient, to apply water to new lands, new uses, and then also put some of that conserved water back in stream. There are other western states that don't have, that have not added on these aspects to their water law. And for this, we're rather proud. So here's an example of how the department manages water rights. We found this graphic to be quite helpful for folks because it helps demonstrate the fact that you may have a junior water right. This is a person who stood in line and got their water right more recently than the senior folks. But he's further up in the watershed and actually physically sees the water come by first. But under this system of prior appropriation, if it's in a time of scarcity and uses need to be ratcheted back, our water master will go work with the junior user and make sure that that water passes by his diversion and gets downstream to the senior folks who may be down below. So this is one example of the type of work that our water masters are out there doing in the field. And we have a picture of someone taking a water measurement in the stream. So very briefly, we wanted to share with you some of the challenges that we're seeing and the foundations that already exist as we move forward, understanding our water resources, meeting water needs, and managing those resources. First, understanding our water resources. We have surface water because of our water rights system that is mostly fully allocated, especially in the summertime. The map that's up here in front of you, all the brown spots show you where streams and their waters are fully allocated. There's just a little bit of blue, a little bit of water available for future applicants to come to the department and make an application for water rights. Compare that map to our winter maps that show much more water in blue that is available for allocation. Now, I will point out that there's a value in having water in stream in the winter. There are flows that are very important for the in-stream functions I talked about earlier. And so it may result that some of the allocations will be for in-stream uses. But the fact remains that there are flows available there in the winter time. We're talking more as a state about storage, particularly underground storage, and these are the flows that we would look to help supply those storage systems. So that was surface water. Looking to groundwater, there's an evolving story there as well. As our surface waters have become more fully allocated, the state has turned its gaze to groundwater, and in recent years we have seen more applications for groundwater projects coming through. The colored areas that are up there in front of you are areas that we have determined administratively as at the department as areas that need further protection. So the darker orange areas are critical groundwater areas. And you can see they're mostly focused on in the eastern portion of the state, but there are some in the the valley as well, in the Willamette Valley. And these areas are places where groundwater levels have dropped precipitously over the past many years, in some cases more than 500 feet. And in those areas, we are limiting not only future applications, but also making some determinations about current water right holders and limiting their use today as well. The lighter areas are groundwater limited areas, and those restrictions are not quite as stringent. We're looking forward and have placed some restrictions on future use, but not today's current water right holders. This map, I think, is particularly powerful because it shows us where we may be going. And this is a look at snowpack in Oregon. Well, let me rephrase that. This is a look at the potential impacts of climate change. And so this is a map that we commissioned from the Climate Change Impacts Group at the University of Washington, and they partnered up with U of O to create this research for us. What you're looking at is a map of land mass that depends on mid-level snowpack. So the red areas are not the snowpack itself, but it's the population centers and the agricultural lands in Oregon who are dependent on mid-level snowpack for their water supplies. So just make sure that's clear. The importance of this is because this mid-level snowpack, it represents natural storage for us. This is snow that stays around in the wintertime and then melts and runs off and goes into our streams and rivers during springtime when we need them for irrigation flows, for fish and wildlife flows, and for municipal needs as well. This is the mid-level snowpack that is in most danger when it comes to climate change. This is what our scientists are telling us. Climate change will likely bring the same amount of precipitation to Oregon, which is the good news, but it will likely come as rain instead of snow. And so what we'll lose is natural storage. And what we'll gain is rainfall and runoff that is much faster and much earlier in the season than we are traditionally used to. So this implies some policy questions for us. And that is, if we lose some storage but still have precipitation, what do we do? And there are a whole range of possibilities that we talk about as a department with our stakeholders and our commission that I think will be of some discussion in our state as we move forward. So meeting Oregon's water needs, this is both the in-stream needs and the out-of-stream consumptive needs. The U.S. Census Bureau is telling us that we will likely see another million people in Oregon by 2030, and maybe more than that if climate change chases some folks away from their homes. So we're talking about those as a climate migration. Those numbers are not even reflected in these population statistics. One of the things that we've done in the past year, and this is one of the successes that we're building upon, is the Oregon Water Supply and Conservation Initiative. And this is part of our 2007 budget, and this is a project that has several components to it. One of the things we're most proud about this project is a statewide water demand forecast that we've put together with some outside private contractors in the last year. And this is just a very quick screenshot of the base case scenario of water demand increasing. And what we did was we said, keeping all things equal, the amount of the per capita water use that we see now times that population projection that was on the previous slide, this is the kind of demand that we might see in the future. Obviously, that begs some questions about, do we really need that kind of water per person? Are there things that we can do to level that line off? And some really nice policy questions that come up as part of this. Our team put together not only the data, but also some methodology and some spreadsheets that we can use as tools moving forward. This is now up on our website and is available for county planners and other policymakers to kind of ask some policy questions and play with a little bit as they move forward. So that's a whole other presentation we would love to share with you at some point. The second component that we addressed as part of this initiative was an inventory of potential water conservation opportunities. We took a survey of irrigation districts, cities, counties, and other water users and asked them where they had some conservation opportunities that they could see in the future, projects they've not yet implemented, but they've been thinking about. We got a really nice response from folks. 72% of our respondents were municipal, so that's the maroon, reddish piece of the pie charts over there. And most of the projects that we heard about, let's see, from the agricultural side were capital infrastructure projects, and most of the projects that we heard about on the municipal side from municipal folks were more programmatic, so education and outreach, incentives and rebates, those types of projects. There's a lot more work to do there to uncover conservation opportunities as a state, and I think particularly since agriculture comprises more than 80% of that consumed water, there will be some nice opportunities to work with that industry there and develop some opportunities in the future.
Brenda, just a quick question about that. Do you know if are any of those projects, would they be eligible, say, under the federal stimulus package? I'm thinking about big municipal water supply projects, probably not some of the smaller ones, but I'm just curious if you've done that analysis yet, if any of those, and I'm assuming it was a pretty big number when you totaled up all the projects.
Madam Chair, that the survey response actually came from about 100 organizations, so it was not a large a sample as we would have liked. That's work to do in the future. But there was a lot of overlap in there of projects, particularly from the irrigation districts, mm-hmm. that are now, I know, finding their way onto the infrastructure projects that are being collected and moved forward as part of the economic stimulus work. Yes, there was quite a bit of opportunity there.
Madam Chair, just
sure.
Just a quick point of interest. I mean, in my part of the country, where that's the critical groundwater was up in Umatilla County and Morrill County, basically. But farmers in that area are now using global positioning, infrared. They've made their water conservation, and I think it's like a 70% savings at this point. I mean, is there any sort of recognition with the Water Resource Department that some folks have already done the water conservation, and how much farther can they go? Is there something that your department has done with that?
Madam Chair, Senator, we know that folks in your community have made great strides in conservation and actually look to them in terms of their leadership, the modeling that we can use to do outreach to other communities. I think that that's definitely known and appreciated, and when we go about designing projects in the future or techniques and efficiencies, that would definitely be one region that we would want to take a look at in terms of the model.
Thank you.
And Senator, I have some ideas about when we're looking at criteria of funding for projects, I think that should be part of it. You know, okay. Certainly for communities that are already doing a lot in conservation, I think they should be rewarded for that. So I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes, like with the health care, you know, Oregon did such a good job, we get penalized because did a good job. So what I'm trying to do is protect my guys out there who have mm-hmm. done a good job, and so they're not penalized and say, well, you have to get 70% more out of the 70% you've already got. So I just wanted to bring that to the committee's attention.
Exactly. The third component, and I'll move along here, is another inventory that the department conducted this past year. This is potential water storage sites, and this becomes extremely important when you pair it with the climate change snowpack map that I showed a little bit earlier. If one of the policy options that we decide to pursue as a state is additional storage, then our department has put together over the past year potential sites, both above and below ground, and we've mapped these on interactive maps so that folks can click on particular sites and get a wealth, a plethora of information that's out there. What we tried to do was act as a clearinghouse for a lot of studies and work that's already been done. And we collected information from federal agencies, other state agencies, local government, public and private companies, and asked them for any work that they'd done previously on these sites. What we're trying to do is help communities avoid reinventing the wheel if they want to look at potential storage sites or have a foundation that they can base further studies on. So this is a great starting point for folks to use. And again, this is all up on our website. The fourth component of the initiative is a community water resource planning grant that we were able to provide in 2008 to about 15 or 16 communities, a total of $200,000. So it's very little amount of seed money, but it was enough in many of these cases to get folks to convene conversations for the first time as a region and start those wider community water planning discussions. We have another grant program that I wanted to touch upon just briefly that we also ran in 2008. When you think about project development, you have your planning stage, and then you have your feasibility studies. This is often where you do your environmental and your engineering studies, and then you have your implementation and project construction. So in this middle phase, it's very difficult to find funding for feasibility studies. You can't, you don't have bonding authority there. It's often difficult to make the case for grants. And so what we were hearing from water users and customers was that this stage is crucial in terms of funding and moving forward in project development. These are the grants that we provided to communities under Senate Bill 1069 from the February session, and were able to get those awarded after our commission meeting last November. Meeting Oregon's water needs, one of the things that we'll talk about as we move into this session is this idea of a long-term integrated water resources strategy, which is kind of a mouthful, but in essence, it's a plan to move forward. Oregon is one of two western states that does not have a water supply plan. And so while our commission has the statutory authority to move forward with an integrated strategy with the department implementing, we realize that we need to partner with DEQ, water quality folks, and a wider array of agencies and stakeholders in order to do the kind of planning the state really needs for its water resources moving forward. The vehicles for this discussion, as you'll see in the next couple months, are Senate Bill 193 that provides some of that clarifying language, and it also shows up in our budget and DEQ's budget for the staff to move this forward. We're building upon a strong foundation. The programs that I just mentioned to you provide a good basis for demand work, supply, conservation, and storage projects that will all be part of this discussion. Continuing managing our water resources, these are some of the things that I'll discuss in the follow-up slides. Partnering with our communities. I wanted to share this slide with you because this is a graphic that you probably saw last month in the Oregonian. And this is actually the project that we've been talking about. Senator Nelson is quite familiar with it, the Umatilla Basin Aquifer Recharge Project. And this is one of the specific feasibility studies that was funded under Senate Bill 1069 last February. This project is doing very well with its feasibility work and is ready to likely move forward here in the next couple months with implementation. And so this is a specific named project that is in the department's budget for $2.5 million. And will be the discussion as we move forward. You'll find it now in House Bill 5535. So I wanted to draw your attention to that project. And we'll get into more details further in the session. And the other thing that we wanted to cover briefly were the staffing needs for the department. I mentioned all of the different responsibilities and roles that we have, and we are actually at fewer FTE, less staff now, staff resources, than we were a decade ago, where the work and the technical complexities are more than they were. The department is being asked to do more. The resource is more complex, and this is a discussion that we'll be having as we go forward. Wanted to talk a little bit about the protection and stewardship of groundwater, and these are discussions that we'll be having as part of two fee bills that will be coming up down the hall later this week in Representative Cannon's committee, and these are House Bill 2231 and 2232 that talk about the importance of our well inspection program and making sure that we keep that whole. 2231 is a discussion of raising fees for start cards from $125 to $225 per well. And these are fees that pay for the department's well inspection program, making sure that we have folks on the ground there when construction is taking place and immediately thereafter to inspect the site and make sure that the groundwater is protected in the process. And the second bill that you'll see is 2232, establishing a new fee for what we call geotechnical holes. These are test holes that public agencies and private companies drill in order to gain more information about subsurface water and soils. And this information is collected, processed, and posted to the Internet by our staff for use by public and private organizations across the board to make sure they have baseline information that they need. So these are two fee bills that we will be discussing further just this in the next couple of days. Lastly, the data needs having to do with groundwater and surface water are great for our agency. We have one bill that will be coming forward in the next couple of days, specifically focused on water use measurement of surface water, and that's Senate Bill 194. So one to keep an eye out on. Whoops. Yeah, go there. And lastly, in a different category, meeting economic development goals, you'll see Senate Bill 195 coming up. This is a focus on wave energy. It builds upon House Bill 2925 from the last session and also Joint Memorial 22, which talked about the importance of diversifying Oregon's energy resource portfolio and also providing economic development. The need for this particular bill is that currently small wave energy projects are not allowed to connect to the grid. And so this is a request for them to be able to connect to the grid and gain a return on investment while providing for some exceptions to ORS 543, providing for adaptive management, and allowing a special advisory committee to recommend siting standards. It also allows our Water Resources Commission to require additional protections while this exemption's in effect. So those are the portfolio that you'll see coming forward from the department over the next couple of months, restated here.
Great. Thank you very much. Any questions for Dr. Bateman? Okay. Well, thank you for that preview, and I know we'll be seeing a lot more of you during and throughout the session. And certainly if you want to stick around for the next presentation, since I know you are an integral part of the water roundtables, certainly there might be some questions there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And next, we're going to hear from Dr. Campagna. He's going to provide an overview on the statewide water roundtables, and I think he also has a presentation. You guys are all high-tech today.
Madam Chair, are we going to get copies of this?
As part of the record? Yeah, we have copies of one coming up, and then Dr. Bateman, could you provide to the committee staff a PowerPoint presentation to copies of that? You can email it to us also if you want to save paper. That's acceptable with everybody here. Okay.
Madam
you.
Chair,
welcome.
Members of the committee, and distinguished Senator Nelson, visitor. My name is Michael Campana.
He's a name tag up there. I think, yeah.
I direct the Institute for Water and Watershed at the place where President Obama's brother-in-law works. Oregon State University. He did have the scarf on.
Yes.
Senator Przanski, is that how I pronounce your name?
Przanski.
I wanted to respond to your question about ancient water, since that's what I started doing many, many years ago. As a hydrogeologist, when someone says ancient water, groundwater, to me that means something on the order of thousands or more years old. And you cited the example of the Mackenzie Basin groundwater, which is 22 years old. To me, that's a juvenile. I mean, that's youngster. But, for example, some of the waters in the Umatilla Basin are in excess of, say, 20, 30,000 years old. And when I say old, that simply means from the time that it entered the ground after it fell as rain or snow to the time it exited either through a pump or a spring, it was about 20 or 30,000 years. So, yeah. So that's one of the problems we face with groundwater. I believe most of you have heard about the water roundtables. This is just a little... You should have copies of these slides. And for those of you in the audience, there's some slides there, but everything is now on this website. In fact, this very presentation was posted there this morning. And so if you want to look at it in color, you're certainly welcome to. Basically, these were a series of five meetings that were held around the state this past fall, September and October 2008, where, in brief, if you look down at the bottom, we just wanted to listen to what Oregonians were thinking about water and what some of their concerns were, and then to report what those concerns were. And you've seen some of these articles that came out in the papers a few weeks ago, Capital Press, the Oregonian, Gazette Times in Corvallis, and other papers as well. And, of course, they all picked up on the negative stuff, you know, Oregonians, water supply concerns, Oregonians, confidence in Oregon's water supply evaporates, blah, all this kind of stuff. I do want to include one thing that was kind of a little kernel of optimism. This was from the local, the Corvallis Gazette Times, and they, when they called me, they said, we think we might want to do an editorial as well as a story. And I said, oh, boy, here, you know, editorial. But actually, they picked up on some of the positive things I said, and I love the headline writers, Good Water News Submerged in Report. So anyway, and I'll talk about some of this a little bit later. We had five of these roundtables. These are the locations, the participants at each location. Now, you'll note that we only had 301 participants attend, okay, out of a population of somewhat a little bit short of 4 million people. We were actually pleased that we got that many. But we don't claim that this represents a random sample of Oregonians. And so if you start trying to analyze the statistics, for example, if you look in some of those newspaper articles, you know, Oregonians are depressed about such and such. Well, it's some subset of 301 Oregonians. So you need to take that, please take that into account. The idea is attributed to then Representative, Madam Chair, Senator Dingfelder now, was discussed at our advisory board meeting last spring. These are just some of the background issues. We did raise money to fund these roundtables. We selected five locations. We did miss some locations that some people were a little, no one was really angry, but we wanted to get to Pendleton or Hermiston or that area. We didn't, and this was mainly because of time constraints. We wanted to have these done by the end of 2008 so that we could present them to the legislature and the governor. The participants were generally self-selected. Okay. These are the people, these are the financial sponsors, and when I say financial sponsors, these are the people that actually put in some cash. There were, of course, in-kind sponsors as well, but we did solicit these, and we're thankful to all these people because we could not have done it. We collected on the order of, I think, $20,000, and that's what it cost. In fact, we ran over a little bit. So the basic format, and again, you can read through all these, but each one was 6 hours long. We did start off with a free lunch. We had some introductory comments, generally from Senator Dingfelder in Ontario. We had Representative Cliff Bentz, who helped us out immensely. After the comments, we did some large group facilitation to find out what people were really concerned about with respect to water. Then we took a break, and when I say break, we had 90 minutes of expert presentations to provide some additional background on water issues tailored to that specific location. We then had a larger facilitation where we had breakout groups. We identified more water issues. We set priorities. We asked people to list outcomes, proposed solutions, who the players were, et cetera. And then finally, the breakout groups reported to the entire group, and then we had some concluding remarks. And I do want to acknowledge the roundtable facilitators. These people donated their time. Terry Buchholz of David Evans and Associates was the lead facilitator. God bless her. She did a fabulous job. Megan Kleibacker assisted her. OSGE stands for Oregon Sea Grant Extension. And then the rest of us pitched in, too. So we're really appreciative of these folks. Now, who attended these roundtables? Well, as you might guess, just like the entire population, there were a broad range of water users. They were very knowledgeable. Again, these people were self-selected. And they expressed a broad range of concerns about water issues, not just water quantity, but water quality, rights, ecosystem, climate change, water pricing, water markets, existing water rights. Amazing. And in general, they weren't optimistic about current or future water supplies. And when I say that, what I mean is that we asked a series of 8 questions to each of the participants, and one of the questions was, are you optimistic about Oregonians' ability to acquire enough water for all its needs in 2008? And on average, about 70% of those responding said, no, we're not optimistic. And then when we ramped it up to 2028, 20 years hence, they were slightly more pessimistic. In fact, I think Ontario and Newport were the most pessimistic. They said 80% of those responding. Now, again, keep in mind this is not a random sample, and, of course, that's what the newspapers picked up on. You know, Oregonians are depressed and stuff about that. So, anyway, these are the participants' interests, and when I say interests, essentially it's kind of a synonym for background. We had citizens there, 23%. We had people representing agricultural, academia. We had elected officials, resource managers, developers, NGOs, all over the map, people in the forestry industry. So we got a real good mix of people, and they were very knowledgeable people. In fact, this little pie chart illustrates when we ask the people, what is your primary water supply source? Only 1% or 3 people didn't really know what their supplies were. Okay, everybody else knew, yeah, it's surface water, yeah, it's a domestic well, municipal supply, etc. So these people knew where the water was coming from. What did they care most about? When we first did the facilitations at each roundtable, we tried to lump everything into one of these 5 themes or issues: water quality, quantity, economics, ecological, and then finally social. And social is that 1% there, which I'll explain. So when we polled the people to see what they were interested in, they, you know, 25% said, I'm most interested in the ecological aspects of water. 16%, I'm interested in the economic aspects. Now, the social, that doesn't mean that the people who came are antisocial or anything like that. It's just that this was a little bit tricky because social means things like outreach and education, and it doesn't mean that they're not interested in that. At least this is what I take it to mean. It means that if they were interested in education about water quality, they would lump it in with water quality, not social. So the social is probably best not shown at all because people say, gosh, what's going on here? We had a number of expert presentations. The agencies, Water Resources, Fish and Wildlife, and Environmental Quality, the state agencies, were extremely helpful. Corps of Engineers, district managers, representations from cities, municipalities, NGOs, a couple of academics in there. And I do want to acknowledge some people individually, directors Phil Ward of Water Resources, Roy Elliker of Fish and Wildlife, Dick Peterson of DEQ, and the governor's office for their support and help, and particularly the 3 directors, because on some occasions I actually called them up and said, can you get a representative out to Ontario like in 3 days or something to give a presentation? And they said, yes, we can do that. So they were really extremely helpful. Some of the representative issues that were identified, and if you look on that, if you dare to go on our website, we have a bunch of spreadsheets that you can download. And we have, I think, maybe 20 or 30 of these spreadsheets, because at each roundtable, when we did the facilitations, we entered all the issues on these spreadsheets and all the solutions and all the players. And so they're kind of ugly. And so what I'm doing here is I'm trying to summarize of some of the 100 or so issues that were identified, the things that stuck out the most to those of us who attended. So I don't want to put any you know, one is more important than the other, but you can see these. There's concern about water and wastewater infrastructure. A big one, if you look at the 3rd bullet, was protection of existing water rights and uses. So whatever happens in the future, people are concerned that those people with existing rights, we don't want to see those folks penalized. Okay. Water quality, of course, climate change impacts, Interstate water allocation and management, that was a concern in some places, particularly those folks in the Snake Columbia Basin right on the river, concern about, say, what Washington and Idaho might be doing vis-a-vis the Snake and the Columbia. So those things were very important. If you go by specific location, some of the interests, excuse me, when I say issues, if you look on the left-hand side, the left-hand axis there, the y-axis, that indicates the number of particular issues that were lumped into a certain category. For example, if you go to water quantity all the way on the left-hand side, and we look at, say, Bend, which is that right there, 15 individual issues we felt belonged in the water quantity category. So the people in Bend were interested in water quantity. If you go to Salem, if you go to planning, it looks like a lot of people in Salem were interested in planning. And so, again, this is just we're trying to lump things. Naturally, when you have a lot of information, which we did have, you try to aggregate it so that people make a little you can make a little sense out of it. Some of the messages that we received, key messages were there was concern for integrated water management planning and implementation. There was also a very strong emphasis in virtually all of the regions that, please, one size does not fit all when it comes to managing water, that regional solutions are needed to meet regional needs. Again, the protection of existing water rights and uses rose to the top. Concerns about public information and education about water and water management. And the last bullet, more support for state agencies involved with water, and this was particularly the Water Resources Department. A number of people felt that WRD did not have enough people to do all the stuff that they're supposed to be doing. And it wasn't just Water Resources, ODF&W and a few others, but I think Water Resources, since they have the primary responsibility for allocating water, or the responsibility, people thought of them. This quote from Ontario, which I think appeared in one of the articles, I think sums up a lot. We need to do it ourselves. I won't read through this whole thing, but essentially they're saying, like, we know our area, and we would like to have a bigger say or a say when it comes to managing and allocating, or say managing water resources. The people who attended, again, were very knowledgeable. Some people had obviously been thinking about some solutions to some of these problems for quite a long time. And these were some of the potential solutions. Again, if you go to these spreadsheets and look through them, and again, they are quite daunting. There are literally scores of solutions to a variety of problems that people had came up with. I was talking with Jerry Schmidt outside before the meeting started, and the second bullet here, obviously tax credits. This is not the time, I think, to be advocating tax credits in this economic climate, but this is what some people suggested, water conservation tax credits. Reuse, recycling, markets, pricing, incentives, all kinds of things. Water storage and conservation. There was, of course, concern in your neck of the woods, Senator, about aquifer storage and recovery and storing. If there is excess water, storing it underground and then using it in the summer. So that came up quite a bit. Interstate compacts as well. This last or next to last slide, these are strictly my impressions, so I'm not trying to say my colleagues who facilitated necessarily agree with these, but since I'm giving the talk, I can do this. The first bullet was that locals seem to be ahead of state government, and I put ahead in quotes because that, when you read that, it says, well, it looks like state government is not doing the job. And the answer is, remember, state government has to deal with the entire state. They have to deal with all the regions. And so they can't think about each region individually as much as or as well as the people who actually live there. So to me, the people who live in a region should be ahead of the state or the feds or something when it comes to managing water or looking at regionally based solutions. Again, water rights and exempt wells were issues that I wasn't expecting that they would be of such concern, but they were. And, you know, we had a lot of people there who were on opposite sides of the fence when it came to water. You can't talk about water without people fussing about it. And if you're not fussing about it, then there probably aren't any problems or anything. Everything is fine. But what I found was, despite disagreements, the stakeholders with disparate views generally got along real well. And I facilitated several sessions, and I was actually very pleasantly surprised when you saw people that you knew came from different camps talking about, you know, not raising their voices. And this is not to say that there wasn't some contention. There were places where voices were raised, which is, you know, par for the course. And so I came away there with optimism that the future is, I'm not saying it's all rosy, but I'm saying there's some very bright people out there that I didn't know about who are thinking about these problems and have some interesting solutions. And so I think that's what the editorial in the Gazette Times picked up on. And as you know, this is the 100th anniversary, or coming up on the 100th anniversary of the Water Code Centennial. And so my colleague Todd Jarvis made up this nice little animated slide here, and he put up all these different things that have gone on in the past year. Most of them are things that we at Craig Robinson School have been involved in, so it is kind of a little bit of a plug. But you can see there's a lot of stuff going on with water, and we haven't even touched that yet. So if you have comments or questions, or if you want me to come give this presentation to your folks, I'd be glad to do that. We've been making the rounds with the various commissions, and this is our first, thanks to the Madam Chair, this is our first presentation here, but if you want us to come speak to your Rotary Club or the Farm Bureau or the Grange or something like that, give me a call or shoot me an email. I'll be glad to do that. And so I thank you very much, and I'll take any questions if you have them or comments.
Thank you, Dr. Campagna. And I do want to I want to leave a few time for questions. We have a few minutes, but I just wanted to say how pleased I was with the work that the Institute did. I mean, you guys put a lot of work into this, and I really think that Dr. Campagna deserves a lot of kudos, because he did all of the logistics of these, which are very, very complicated, and did it in a very professional manner. And I just want to say it was a great experience working with university, and appreciate all the hard work of your staff and pulling together a lot of different staff. I also am very pleased that we've been able to share the results as much as possible. Yeah. And I know that you might want to mention that you've already presented to the different commissions. In
Water Resources, DEQ, and the Fish and Wildlife Commission, the Oregon Water Utilities Council meeting December 9th, a couple of watershed councils, Kalapuya. I think Todd's done a couple other ones, but we've probably given about 8 or 9 or 10 of similar presentations.
And obviously you've gotten some good coverage in the press, but I certainly encourage you to visit their website and look at the results, the more detailed results. And as somebody who went to 4 out of the 5 roundtables, we do have somebody who just left who was at all 5 of them.
It was Helen. Yes. Helen Moore. Yeah.
From Water for Life.
Helen was there.
At all of them. Part of the constraint was financial as well. You said time, but ideally we would have liked to have 10 or 15 of these around the state, but unfortunately we can only do what we can do with our budget. So I encourage you, if you're able to get some more funding, to continue the conversation with Oregonians. I found it very valuable as a policymaker, because we hear from certain people in this building. And my interim committee, by the way, I think I only held one hearing in Salem, partially because there was construction going on in this building. So I used that as an opportunity to get out around the state. We were in Senator Nelson's district. We were in Central Oregon. We were out at the coast for one meeting. So
Newport,
So the roundtables, though, were really valuable, because we heard from a different voice that I usually hear from in this building, and I really appreciated that. And the diversity of folks was amazing. Mm-hmm. I was also impressed, as you said, with the knowledge and the creativity. I mean, we heard some really interesting solutions. You saw some of it here today. Of course, some of those take funding, but others are, don't. So I was really pleased and appreciate all the work that you've done. So with that, if there's any questions for Dr. Campagna? Senator Nelson?
With all the presentations from Dr. Bateman also, but I just wrote down three things. I mean, three things struck out: the industry versus the agriculture, industrial uses. The presentation, and I think Dr. Bateman made the point, is that, 80% of the use is agriculture, but that's not 80% of the amount of water. And so, at some point, I'd like to see what the in-stream uses are, and you know how much water really is being used for all the purposes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can ask the department to come back and provide that with us with that
and
information.
And the second was the amount of water needed projected. I mean, one of the slides indicated there was 1 million people projected coming into the state, and you know. And I thought that the chart showed about 1.5 million acre feet of water, which is a lot of water. And I
think it depends on the use again.
Yeah, it depends on the use of that. And then the third was on conservation. How much conservation are we doing now, and how much can we expect for conservation to fulfill the amount of the water that's going to be needed? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, those are all good questions, and these are all issues that we have to grapple with.
I would mention, if Madam Chair, that Dr. Bateman gave her talk, and the climate, the projections of population, she specifically mentioned, took it after my own heart, that doesn't include potential climate refugees.
Dr. Campagna is a climate refugee, moved from New Mexico.
That's good. I'm ahead of the curve, but there are a couple million behind me.
Oh.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but Patricia Mulroy, I don't want to digress, the esteemed director of the Southern Nevada Water Authority, publicly in a meeting in Washington at the Brookings Institution, urged the federal government to build a project to bring Mississippi River floodwater to the west. And I have not heard that plan since I was a graduate student in the early 70s, and then it was laughed out of the room by the end of the 70s, and it's coming back, believe me.
That's more radical than me.
Well, I know.
I use Columbia River water.
She said we need to do things that would be considered outrageous by today's standards to meet water needs in the West. And she was serious. She doesn't usually, she's not given to hyperbole. So anyway, I'll leave that. Otherwise, I'll get started on something else.
Well, I remember when I lived in Southern California, they were talking about bringing icebergs down from Alaska, so it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility. So any other questions for Dr. Campagna? Yeah. We have Senator Boquist.
No, Madam Chair, I would like to second what Senator Nelson said. I'd like to see the 80% defined by Water Resources Department along with the forecast so that we have a grasp of what it is we're really dealing with.
I need to see Brenda nodding her head back there.
She's back there. She's writing.
I was going to say she's either hiding or she's writing. Okay.
Right.
Well, any other final comments you'd like to make? I know that you're
part of
the university.
I enjoy doing this. This was great. I mean, this not just
thank
presentation, but this whole, these roundtables, they were very enjoyable. There's some smart people out there.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate your partnership in doing this and look forward to our continued working relationship with the university. And we will say that there was many different elements at the Oregon State University and with University of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
That we work together, and we actually are going to hear from a University of Oregon person on the nexus between climate change and energy and water, I think in the next week or so. And so that there are two big issues here that we'll be dealing with, both climate change and the impacts on water. And I can't, emphasize enough that those are two issues we'll be grappling with and some big challenges facing us, because this is sort of uncharted territory that nobody's really had to deal with. And we have the 100th anniversary of the Oregon Water Code, so there's a lot of things we'll be looking at, and how that impacts our current water code, I think, is really important. So really appreciate your work. We'll probably be calling on you to come back to get your expertise in this committee. So
thank you.
Appreciate it.
And I do want to add, as some of you know, we've lured the Washington State climatologist, Phil Moat, to come down here. And as someone mentioned, I said, I guess that's evidence that the Washington budget crisis is worse than Oregon's.
Actually, we've invited him to come speak to our committee next week. So
okay.
I think we'll have
great
a visit from here.
We're glad to get someone like that here. So
great. With that, I will close the informational hearing and adjourn the committee, and we'll see you on Thursday.